I guess I get started by introducing myself. My name is Abe Cho, and I am an assistant pastor at Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City. And so, Barry, I can actually assure you that Tim didn't steal your stuff from the book for his book, because that was my stuff. So just arrived, and so kind of, my head's kind of spinning a little bit, but I guess before just diving into this topic for today, I just maybe want to start with a disclaimer. I don't know, part of it might be just wanting to cover my own behind, but just to let you know that a lot of these thoughts for me are actually half-baked at best. And so these are things that I'm only beginning to think through, and so there are a lot of you here who are probably farther along on this journey of understanding these sorts of things. And so I'm just thankful for the opportunity to be forced to think a little bit more clearly on this. But a lot of these are half-baked thoughts, and I actually really look forward to some of the questions and interactions and to be able to learn from you in the context that you've been in, your interactions with power and that sort of a thing. So I present them tentatively with a little bit of fear and trembling. They don't have the years or the experience that a guy like Barry or a guy like Randy is going to be beginning to bear on the subject. So we'll have some. I think it'll probably sound a little bit green at times, but that's okay. You know, we got to start somewhere. So that's where we are, and I really am looking forward to some of the interaction. And the topic that I'm talking about is basically the topic of power. And how it came to be that I was asked to talk on the topic of power is basically in a meeting I opened my big mouth, and I said, if we're going to talk about reconciliation and justice, surely we must talk about power. And they said, yes, Abe, you should. You really should. So that's where I am now. So we're talking about power, maybe one of the most slippery concepts to deal with. At least it proved to be for me as I sat and reflected on some of these things. Because it can mean so much and it can mean so little. And we could be talking about several different things and using the word power to kind of describe that. So it's a really slippery thing. And on top of that, it's actually a very, I guess it's kind of a scary thing to talk about. Power is not something that we talk about as much. In churches, we'll talk about sex, even though even that's a little bit uncomfortable. We'll talk about money. We'll talk about these other things. But to talk about power kind of gets us into uncharted territory. And for some people, it might put them on the defensive. For other people, it might kind of raise hostilities or concerns and that sort of thing. So all sorts of different responses to this idea of power. And yet, when I sat and thought through this idea of power is just so central to the gospel. Power, weakness, spiritual power. What does it mean that the church is empowered? All these sorts of things started to kind of flood through. And then I started to get confused and lost. But I'm trying to kind of sort my way out of it. So why power? I think when we talk about reconciliation, there's always, always, always some sort of power dynamic going on there as well. It's very rare, and maybe I'll even venture so far as to say it's never the case that reconciliation is happening between two groups of people or even two individual peoples where power dynamics are equal. Very rare. I would venture so far as to say it never happens. There's always some sort of power dynamic at play that complicates matters in ways that we have a hard time articulating. We have a hard time helping people to see. And so if you're standing from the position of powerlessness in our society to try to explain to somebody whose entire life has been power and privilege, the words just don't cut it. And yet if you're on the other side and you're standing from the position of power and privilege and you hear all this stuff, you just say, I don't get it. It sounds like a whole lot of complaining, and shouldn't you just be working harder and going into Ivy League schools like all of us good Asian kids did? Like, I don't understand. And we talk about that, and our language fails us because there's such a great distance. We have a hard time thinking about time. So reconciliation and justice even of itself, justice demands that power is being used rightly. That's at the heart of it. Power is being used rightly. Power, I think Dr. King would say, is justice is power used in the service of love. That it's all wrapped up into that. So reconciliation and justice, power is in the mix. Another reason why I think it's important for us to talk about power is, if we're honest, we're actually never really fully aware of how much power we actually have. So when it comes back to the idea of money, all of us know exactly how much money we have. So we could talk about, do I have a lot? Do I not have a lot? Am I rich? Am I poor? We could talk about that. Or even when it comes to the topic of sex, we could talk about how much sex we have. We know it's a fairly concrete thing to be able to quantify. But when it comes to power, there is, I don't know. I don't know how much power I have. At times I feel powerless, depends on who I'm with. At other times I feel empowered and powerful, depends on who I'm with. How much power do I actually have? And so just the squishiness and the slipperiness of this concept of power, what it usually does is it leads us to not think about it. And when we're not thinking about it, we're going with the flow of the world. We're going with the flow of society. And it's slippery, it's messy, we're not quite sure how to get our arms around it, and yet we're called as Christians, I think, to think very closely and very carefully about the topic of power. So that's the second reason. A third reason why I feel like we need to talk about power is simply for the fact that power is inescapable. There is no way to step away from power completely. There's no way to forsake it altogether. Even when we talk about a theology of weakness, there's still power dynamics in play there. And so if power is inescapable, and it's impossible for us to forsake power consistently, and if we're not thinking about power, we're just going to inhabit power as though it's ours to keep. And if we're not thinking along those lines, what we have to ask ourselves is, what does it mean for us to faithfully inhabit power? We have to ask that question. Otherwise, we slip into one side or the other. So that's why I feel like it's an important topic. And again, in my talk, you're going to hear me slipping around a little bit, I'm sure. And in my mind, I'm still slipping around a little bit. But hopefully, as we slip around together, we're learning and we're growing and thinking more deeply on it. So let me begin then with a quick definition of power and unpack why I think this is a helpful definition of power. So if I were to define power, I would say that it's the capacity of an agent, and that agent could be a spiritual being like the power of God, for example, or the power of demons, or the powers and principalities. It's the capacity of an agent, whether a spiritual being, a human person, a group, or an institution, to act in the world and to influence the social environment around them. So I think I might have tweaked it a little bit from what you have in your booklets there. So let me repeat, the capacity of an agent to act in the world to influence the social environment around them. So let me unpack that. Why the capacity of an agent? I think that word agent is important because it acknowledges and it accounts for the fact that various things can hold power. So God himself has power. Spiritual beings have a clear power. Individuals, in my interpersonal relationships, I have a certain power as a person, as an individual. Institutions hold a completely different order of power. And until we're able to recognize that different agents can inhabit power, I think our understanding of power will be overly reductionistic. It'll be too simplistic. So it's an agent. So it takes into account all these different things that can actually exert power. The second thing that I want to unpack there is this capacity of agent to act in the world. And I included the phrase to influence the social environments. And the reason I put that in there is that whenever we exercise power, it always involves people. And to some degree, that's self-evident, I suppose, but we oftentimes forget that all exercise of power impacts people. So it's social environments. And lastly, I used the word influence in there, right? To influence a social environment. And the reason I use the word influence there is that there is formal power, political power, economic power, but there's all sorts of different other kinds of power. And so the word influence to me gets us out of this mindset of you only have power if you have a position of authority, which you certainly do, but power is a lot more dynamic than that. Okay? So there's our definition, the capacity of an agent to act in the world and to influence the social environment around them. Okay? So that's that. So with that definition in place, I want to start off and do a little bit of ground clearing. So we live in the city, which means that we don't often get to go camping. But when we do, one of the things that I've learned, we've only gone like two or three times. After the first time, one of the things that I learned is the most important thing you do before you pitch your tent is you have to clear the ground. So a twig, a lump, a rock, a pebble, if you don't clear the ground, it's going to bother you for the rest of the entire trip. It's going to be miserable. So what I want to start to do is clear the ground a little bit before we start kind of building on it. Just so we make sure that we're all talking about the same thing, at least at some level. Okay, so clearing the ground. And I want to do that by just unpacking what I say are four kinds of power, or four layers of power. And each of these four things in my mind aren't distinct categories. They're kind of on a spectrum, and so they bleed into each other. They spill over. Sometimes they're actually, you can't discern between the two. So it's just, but it's a spectrum, and I think the four layers or types or categories of power are still helpful to clear the ground so we can clarify our thinking. And so the four kinds of power to clear our ground, the first one is what I just call individual power. And this is the power that we have merely by being healthy and being able to move about with relative freedom. This is also the kind of power that comes with having a skill or an ability. That there's certain power that comes along with knowing how to do something. It's a kind of power that has knowledge. And I call it individual power because it's largely expressed at the individual level. But it's a very real power. If there are people who are handicapped and don't have physical abilities, they recognize their position of powerlessness. Again, we take it for granted because in this scenario, we're on the side of power and privilege. So this individual power, the ability to move at will, is actually a remarkable piece of power that we have. And until we lose that, we don't ever really fully appreciate it. So individual power, health, ability, skill, knowledge, that sort of thing. The next kind of power that there is what I call interpersonal power. And this is a power that is expressed between two individuals. And so an expression of interpersonal power might be the power that an extrovert can exert over an introvert in the context of a church meeting. So the introvert's there brewing and thinking and making all these connections and not wanting to say anything until they feel like their words have weight and they're legitimate, and there's something that they want to stand behind because it's going to come out of their mouth. As the introvert is doing that, the extrovert has basically vomited all over the church table, and the conversation has moved on. And even in that moment, there is an expression and exertion of power. And it's an interpersonal kind. Or another example of interpersonal power is the kind of power that we actually have in our relationships within institutions. So the power that I have as a father over my son, that's an interpersonal kind of power. Even though it draws its source from the institution of family, it's an interpersonal kind of power because I exert that to him on an individual, on a one-on-one basis. Okay, that's another kind of power, interpersonal power. Another kind of interpersonal power, I think, is a kind of power dynamics that happen along the lines of race, actually. So when you're having conversations with people of different racial backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds, there is oftentimes an unspoken power dynamic at play there that if we're not attuned or attentive to it, we often just kind of feed into and exacerbate the power dynamics that might already be causing issues to begin with. And that's the power dynamics that come along with race has institutional implications and all that, but even at the interpersonal level, there are real issues there that I'm not fully aware of for sure. But it's something that we at least need to say, are we aware of these things? Are we thinking of them? So there's individual power, there's interpersonal power. The third kind of power is institutional power. And institutional power is a power of another order. Because what happens is institutional power is usually one step removed from the people that this institution has power over. And what happens is in institutions is power is kind of gathered together. A whole another order of power begins to emerge so that the whole is actually greater than the sum of its parts. And the exercise of power within institutions has a greater cumulative effect, generally speaking, than the power of individuals. Okay, and that's another level of power that I think we need to be thinking about and acknowledging. That's institutional. So individual, interpersonal, institutional, and the last one I want to talk about is spiritual power. And spiritual power actually, to me, this is one that really got me confused as I was thinking about it. Spiritual power actually kind of pervades all of them, it seems like. Because on the one hand, we see in the book of Acts that, you know, it's by the power of God that we live and breathe and move and have our being. And so even our individual power is based upon a fundamental and previous spiritual power, that the molecules in a body hold together not merely by the laws of physics, but because of the active hand of God's providence in sustaining us and holding us together. And so the very virtue of the fact that we are constituted human beings that maintain integrity over time as physical bodies is an expression of the spiritual power of God. The fact that grass grows when water falls on it and soil, and that is an expression of spiritual power at the most fundamental level. So it pervades everything. So on the one hand, spiritual power is as fundamental as that. Spiritual power also speaks into our interpersonal power, doesn't it? Because it's the call to community. And it's a call to be one as the people of God, that there is a communal aspect to the expression of spiritual power. And lastly, I think also spiritual power speaks to the institutional level. And I'm not going to have a ton of time to unpack this, but when I see phrases like powers and principalities, rulers and authorities, what I see there is, on the one hand, certainly individual demonic persons, so spiritual beings there. But I also see there that these spiritual beings, these demons, are so pervading an institution that a human institution becomes demonic in its force and thereby becomes a power and a principality no longer under the reign of Christ, but now trying to presume to be God itself, trying to presume to have ultimate authority on its own. And so human institutions become a power and principality the moment it takes final authority for itself and does not acknowledge its submission to the headship of Christ. And so in that sense, the church can become a power and principality. The state can become a power and principality. And it takes on a demonic power. So what I see, that when I think about spiritual power, it pervades everything, because we serve a God who is in all and through all and with all. Okay. So what I want to do today, so having kind of laid out some of that, staked out some of that ground, for the rest of the talk, I want to focus mostly on the interpersonal and the institutional. Okay, so not so much on the individual power, though that's probably an interesting topic in and of itself. And I'm going to kind of take for granted the spiritual power. And I'm going to be basically asking, what does it mean for the spiritual power of God to begin to find expression in our interpersonal and institutional expressions of power? Okay? So that's kind of where I'm going. So I'm trying to hone in there, just so we're not trying to talk about everything all at once, focusing in on the interpersonal and the institutional. So any questions so far? Anything sound crazy? No. Okay. Good. All right. Yeah. Randy.
I notice over here in your small group notes, number 2, it says which of these groups, but you didn't put that as one of the kinds of power. Mm. And I'm just wondering if there, like I think how representation of being from a certain group gives you power you didn't individually earn.
Right.
Like if it's a gang, it comes with menace.
Right. Yeah. No. If you couldn't hear the question was, in the handout, talk about groups and the power within groups. But groups is not one of the four kinds of power that I laid out. And it's a great question. What's behind that? I think for me, at least the way that I've thought through it, but your question at least for me says, well, maybe we do need to think about a fifth expression of power. But to me, I think the group power is primarily brought to expression in interpersonal kinds of relationships, which is not to say that an individual in and of themselves sees this power. So the source of the power might be from a group identity, but where that power really comes to bear is in the interpersonal level, because it's not so much an institution just yet, although maybe it starts to have institutional power dynamics, but it's expressed in that interpersonal dimension. Yeah, but it's a great question. Other questions at this point? Okay, everyone's dragging along. So far, not crazy. It's good. It's one of those things when you think about stuff, you're like, am I going crazy? So it's good to have at least some confirmation that that's not happening for me. Okay, so that's kind of just initial ground clearing. Now I want to dive in a little bit onto the nature of power. And I guess there's a lot that could be said here, so I was trying to boil things down and kind of pull things together as best as I can. And this is what I've come up with again so far. When I look at the Bible, when I think about how power works in society and in creation and that sort of a thing, these are just some basic observations that I think were worthy of pulling out. So the first one to mention is that on the nature of power is that all power is derived in its fundamental nature. Or another way to put it is that all power is borrowed. So there is no power that we inhabit as human beings that is intrinsic to ourselves, that we own, that we're entitled to, that originates with us. The source of all power is God. Now, where do you see that? The place where you see it first and foremost is Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God, etc., etc., etc. The source of all power, in the beginning, it was God who exerts his power, thereby bringing creation into being. And therefore, God is the source of all power in his creation, in the entire universe. And that derived nature of power is actually something that I often think about. So even when I think about my power as a father over my children, when I remind myself, my power as a father over my children is derived. What that means for me means at least two things. It means, one, I am accountable. If my power is borrowed, then that same power is also accountable to him from whom I've borrowed it. So my power is accountable. And secondly, my power, that power cannot be used for my own purposes. If power is derived, if it's borrowed, it's accountable. And it cannot be used for my own purposes. It has been bestowed upon me by the originator of the power in order to accomplish his purposes. And when I think about that just from the level of fatherhood, it shifts my perspective on what I'm supposed to be doing. When I think about that on the level of pastor of a church, it shifts my perspective. When I think about on the level of friends, shifts my perspective. Because all of my power is fundamentally derived and therefore accountable and cannot be used for my own purposes. One place where I see that that's actually fascinating to me is with King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 4. So the King Nebuchadnezzar is pagan god, or pagan king, excuse me, probably a god too, at least in his nation. Pagan king, and he starts to have these dreams. And if you remember, Daniel was in the court of the king. He starts to have these dreams, and he has this one dream of a tree that grows and grows, and the branches fill the entire universe. And then he says, I think the phrase that he uses, and then a watcher, which is a really interesting phrase, someone who was watching, a watcher, comes in and takes an axe to the tree, and it falls down. And then the animals come, and they rip up the stump or something like that. And he comes into Daniel and he says, Daniel, can you interpret this dream? And Daniel essentially says to Nebuchadnezzar, that tree was you and the extent of your power. But there is a watcher. There is a watcher who is about to come and cut it down. And what you're about to become in your intoxication with power, what you're about to become is just like those animals that come in and rip up the stump of that tree. Because you have not used your power in service of justice and righteousness. A pagan king, not part of the covenant of God. And yet the God who is a ruler over all nations says, the power you have is mine to give and to take away. Therefore, it's accountable and it cannot be used for your own purposes. And so I remove you. Because all power in all institutions, in all of our relationships, is fundamentally derived and it's borrowed. And again, where do we ground that? What theological doctrine can we ground that in? And I think it's actually the doctrine of creation. Because what's unique about the Christian faith is that creation is not a part of the body of God, as though God were completely and thoroughly immanent in all of creation. On the one hand, but creation also is not the result of God's fighting and one taking over. So creation, uniquely in the biblical faith, is something that's created by God, so has an integrity of its own, and yet needs God and is utterly dependent upon God. So if that's the nature of creation, what that means then is all of creation has that borrowed aspect to it. You see that? That power, all of creation is completely contingent upon God. That there's nothing intrinsic in creation. Creation didn't exist before God existed, and God merely moved the pieces around, moved the furniture around to make something different. Nor is creation the body of God in some mystical sense. Because both of those things would say power then is intrinsic to creation. Where the Christian faith says that creation is separate from God and yet utterly dependent upon Him. Therefore, there is power, and yet that power is completely borrowed. Okay, so I think it's rooted in the doctrine of creation. So what does that mean practically? Practically, I think what it means that if power is derived, then the question of how do we inhabit power faithfully, if you come back to that question, how do we inhabit power faithfully? I think the answer is we cannot inhabit power by forsaking it altogether, nor can we inhabit power by possessing it as if it were our own. We inhabit power faithfully when we're stewarding it for the purposes of God. So the stewardship of power, it's borrowed, it's lent to us, therefore accountable, therefore not subject to our own purposes. We are inhabiting power faithfully when we are stewarding it for the purpose of God, not forsaking nor possessing it. Okay, so that's the first observation to draw out. All power is derived. And then I leave it to you maybe to kind of tease out what are the implications of that. The second thing I want to pull out is that all power is also relational. So the nature of power is that it always affects people at some level or another. And if I were to just kind of ground this again theologically, to me I think it's grounded in the doctrine of the Trinity. So when we look in the Trinity, what we see is before God even created, God existed as a community of love, so to speak. Absolutely and utterly one, and yet three persons. And it was a love of mutual. It was a relationship of mutuality. It was a relationship of worship. It was a relationship of love. It was a relationship of self-giving. And within that triune nature of God, what we see there is that what's first and foremost is community, is relationship, is love, even before God's first act of power. So community precedes power. Relationship precedes power. If God were a single unity, just one monistic Godhead, God person, then power would have to exist first because He would have to create in order to enter into relationship. Do you see that? But if God is triune, then He's already in relationship, and out of that relationship comes the expression of power. So when we think about God as being triune, what that means to me is that the center of all of reality is relationships, is community. And actually the person that taught me this, I think, at least first introduced me to this thought, was Dr. Martin Luther King, where he talks about the interrelated structure of all of reality. And so in one of his sermons, Christmas Sermon on Peace, I think, he talks about by the time you wake up in the morning, you've already relied upon, you know, the Frenchman who made your bar of soap. You've relied upon the English-speaking baker who made you your toast. You've relied upon the South Americans who raised your coffee. And even before you finished breakfast, you relied upon half the world. Because the nature of reality is that we're utterly interdependent. That there is built into creation this relationality. And so what we have is we have a triune God who is community before He's power, who out of His relationship exerts power to create. So we have a God who is fundamentally triune, and we have a creation that's fundamentally interrelated. That to me kind of fits hand in glove. A triune God you would expect would make a creation that's necessarily interdependent upon one another. That we would have to inhabit each other. That we would have to have a mutuality towards one another. Triune God creates an interrelated reality. And the result of that is any expression of power within that creation is relational. So I'm not saying power should be relational. I'm saying power is relational, whether we acknowledge it or not. Say, I'm not saying power should be used in the service of love in order to build relationships. I'm saying power always, always, always impacts relationships. So if it's not being used in the service of love, it's destroying relationships. And we know that on an interpersonal level, of course. Where we have a hard time seeing that, I think, is at the institutional level. And so there's a great book, which actually I think is a great resource by Robert Linthicum. And it's called, I think it's called Transforming Power. Is that what it's called? Yeah. So a great book, but there's a section where he divides power into two kinds. He divides it into relational and unilateral. And I get where he's trying to go, and I understand that, but I think to me what that does, it runs the risk of saying that institutional power is somehow not relational. But the very danger of institutional power is that it's one step removed from the faces and the eyeballs of the people that it's affecting. And so we can express institutional power thinking that we're just shaping policies or procedures or positions or approaches. And we think we're just dealing in the abstract, but the reality is if power is relational, institutional power is exponentially relational. There are faces and lives associated with any expression of institutional power. And I think when we remove that connection, that's when institutional power really does start to become dangerous, as though we can shape reality without it affecting the people that we're talking about. Okay, so what I'm saying there is that power is fundamentally relational. Not that it should be, but that it is. So what does that mean practically for us? I think it means this: we inhabit power faithfully when we're using it to create more interdependence. So we're inhabiting power faithfully when we're using it to create more interdependence, not independence, even though the gospel of America would tell us that is the goal of our lives. Not using power in order to create independence. And certainly not creating using power in order to create dependence in somebody else. But we faithfully inhabit power as Christians when we're using it to create more interdependence. And so in our breakout, I was talking with a brother, Jason, and we're talking about some of the challenges that we have given our context. Where Redeemer, you know, is a church largely very educated, upwardly mobile professionals in Manhattan. And yet, here we are thinking about these issues and the gospel being for the poor and the kingdom going forth in weakness. And yet, at least for me, I look at my church and I'm like, this is a church of the powerful. And I say, how do I bring all these things together? And I think for me, the question that I wrestle with a lot in my context is, how do I help the rich and the competent and the independent to disavow independence as a goal? How do I help pastor them to say we are made to need each other? And not just the lawyer needing the banker. We're made to need each other across deep differences. How do you do that? I don't know. I have no idea. I haven't figured it out. But I think that's an important question. How do we help shepherd people to think about that? So we inhabit power faithfully when we're using our power to create a situation of interdependence where we all need each other. So that's second. So first, all power is derived. And therefore, we can't forsake it. We can't forsake it. We can't possess it. We must steward it for the purposes of God. The second thing is that power is relational in its very nature, very core. And so therefore, we inhabit power faithfully when we use it to create more interdependence. The third thought that I want to pull out is actually a thought that I have to basically give credit to Andy Crouch, who wrote a book called Culture Making, and I think he's about to release a book called making power, creating power, something like that. And he came and gave a talk at Redeemer on power, which was hugely helpful and totally shaped my thoughts here, without a doubt. So you can see it online as a video. Totally shaped my thoughts. It was a great resource. But one of his key points that I walked away thinking, I got to think a lot more about that, is that he would say that power is inherently generative. Now, what does generative mean? And what I heard him say, and I think this is something that's actually worth a lot of more sustained thought, is that power is not a zero-sum game. As though there are 100 pieces of power out there, and if I own 12 of those pieces, then I see someone who owns 2. If I empower that person, then I'm down to 11 in order for that person to be at 3. He says, power doesn't work that way. Power is not a zero-sum game. Power is generative. So that when you give power away, more power is generated. So the very nature of power is that it was made in order to be given away. And we actually see hints of that in Genesis chapter 1, don't we? That the God of all power creates. And then what does he do? He doesn't create subjects per se. What does he do? He creates rulers. The sun and the moon rule. And he creates Adam and Eve and he says, have dominion. That's the language of power, unapologetic language of power. Subdue. And then he goes so far as to say, name the animals. Don't just take the reality that I've made and express power within it. Shape the reality with me. Give the animals their names. And the implication of Genesis chapter 1 is not that somehow God has given away his power chips to Adam and Eve. So he was at 100%, 100 chips of power before he created, but now he created and he's got to give Adam and Eve power, so he's at like 95. That's not the implication at all, that God in his generous power gives it away and power is generated. It's intriguing to me. It's something that I think merits a lot more thought because I think it would fundamentally affect how we approach power, wouldn't it? Because what the world would say that power is something that we must grasp, accumulate, subject to our own purposes. But that would be a misunderstanding of the very nature of power. That power was meant to be given away. Not really as an expression of weakness, though it certainly looks like that to a completely upside-down world. But power, when it's rightly expressed, is meant to be shared, and it generates more power. The other side, actually, where I see the generative nature of power, so I've been talking about power being given away and how it generates more power, but when power is collected and shared together, we see power generated there too, don't we? That's, again, what we've been talking about is institutions. When people come together and they agree, we're going to pool our power and empower, let's say, a handful of people to be officers or whatnot, that pooling of power is greater than the sum of its parts. So that's why even, and I think Dr. King is on my mind because I gave a talk at Redeemer on Martin Luther King Day. But when he went in his time and in his day, all the boycotts, what were they? There were individuals who shared the same concern, who probably were doing amazing things on their own. And yet when all those people were brought together, were organized, were coordinated, were choreographed, a new order of power emerged out of that. So when power is shared, as in we hold it all together, power is generated. When power is shared in the sense that we're distributing and giving power away, power is generated. If that's true, that really needs to flip our understanding of how we're supposed to use this thing called power. Maybe one other example that I just find interesting, because one example of power is education. And so I think a lot of your churches or a lot of the work that you will do in your neighborhoods will be tutoring programs, other forms of education. But what happens in education is again, it's not a zero-sum game. When the teacher imparts knowledge to, let's say, the 20 people in their class, what happens is everybody walks away with greater power. Right? The nature of power, I think we see it so often, yet it's an insight that we oftentimes overlook. So what does that mean? Well, if I were to ground it in a theological doctrine again, so the first derived is grounded in creation. That power is relational is grounded in the Trinity. That power is generative for me is grounded in the Imago Dei. That again, humanity uniquely has been called to image God and to be vice regents of God in creation. And there's a sharing of power, and there's a bestowal of power there where we see that generative nature of power kind of come out. So what does this mean at a practical level? It means that we inhabit power faithfully when we share it and thus create more power for others. So we inhabit power faithfully when we share it and thus create more power for others. Or the way that Andy Crouch put it in his talk, he says that the true exercise of power results in the creation of more power for others. The true exercise of power results in the creation of more power for others. Okay, so we talked about power is derived, power is relational, power is generative. The fourth thing that I wanted to point out is power is always ambiguous. And I think this is an important thing for us to kind of let resonate and ring in our ears even as we kind of walk away from this place. Power is and always will be ambiguous, and the reason for that is because of sin. We live in a world that's broken, fallen pervasively. We have hearts that are subtly and imperceptibly allured by the promises of power. And if that's the case, that the fall is as pervasive as I think the Bible portrays it to be, then any exercise of power is going to be ambiguous in nature. And so on the one hand, power, I think, will always be ambiguous in its distribution. I think it's just a reality of where we are. Power distribution will never be perfectly equal. But power will also be ambiguous in its outcomes. And this is actually something that I've thought a lot about. And maybe it's because I'm pretty young, and when you're young, you think that if you just do things right, you can fix the world. And I think I still probably believe that at the most deepest level. But at least at an intellectual level, I'm starting to wonder if maybe that's not the case. But even in the outcomes of our right use of power, it's ambiguous. So the great reading a book, and the book brings out this great example. The greatest example of this is the story of Joseph at the end of Genesis, where what we see at the beginning of that story is that Joseph's brothers, I've been saying power too much in this talk, I mean, Joseph's brothers exert interpersonal power by the use of physical force. And they use that power according to their own purposes, evil purposes, which is to sell their youngest brother into slavery. The outcome of that negative use of power is that Joseph ends up in Egypt, and during a time of famine, And the result of that use of power by his brothers is that Joseph ends up in Egypt as essentially the prime minister. And during a time of famine, because of that negative use of power, he's able to save his entire family from famine. But the story doesn't end there, because the use of power actually reverses one more time. Because there's a time when, by the time the book of Exodus opens up, there's a Pharaoh in Egypt who knew not Joseph. And the very exercise of power that saved his family and the people of God and the promise of the Messiah and that entire story, the very exercise of power that preserves the people of God in one generation is precisely the same action that leads to their slavery for the next 400 years. And so when Joseph could have had a moment maybe of a sense of triumph, of accomplishment, of we've done this, we've used power rightly according to the purposes of God, and yet that very expression of power in this generation, that moment of liberation in this generation, becomes the next generation's oppression. Because our use of power will always have an ambiguous aspect to it. And what that means for us is that we must be modest and chastened and humble in all of our attempts to do anything. Because as a verse from Job that has rung in my mind and in my heart for the past year is that because God has plans too wonderful for us. God has plans too wonderful for us. And so we celebrate the victories, and yet we know, but God has plans even more wonderful than this, and I know it not. And even in the times when we feel discouraged, we say, but God has plans more wonderful for us. Because any human use of power this side of heaven will be ambiguous in its outcomes. So we need to be chastened. We need to be cautious. It should disavow our tendency towards triumphalism that maybe is a function of youth, but maybe not. Maybe it's a function of sin. It should humble us. It should lead us to be constantly repenting of our power, even while we're trying to figure out how do I inhabit this power faithfully. The other reason why power will always be ambiguous is the allure of power. And this is something that we will never for our own hearts fully understand the control that power has over us. And to some degree, you know, the story of the Lord of the Rings is actually an extended treatise on power. So you can kind of read it that way. But there is a great part in the Lord of the Rings early on where Frodo is trying to take this ring of power, this ring that rules all the other powers, and if the Dark Lord gets it, then he's going to control the entire world, and somehow it's fallen to Frodo. And Frodo doesn't want anything to do with this ring. And he tries to give it to Gandalf, who is a good wizard and person of great power in and of itself. And so Frodo asks him this. He says, Gandalf, will you not take the ring? No, cried Gandalf, springing to his feet. With that power, I should have power. With that power, I should have power too great and terrible. And over me, the ring would gain a power still greater and more deadly. His eyes flashed, and his face was lit as by a fire within. Do not tempt me, for I do not wish to become like the Dark Lord himself. For the way of the ring into my heart is by pity. Pity for weakness and the desire of strength to do good. Do not tempt me. Talk about a penetrating glimpse into the allure of power, perhaps most particularly poignant for those of us who would say, I just want power to do good. I just want this power to do good. And if we're not honest about the allure of power in our hearts, and if we're not watchful, and if we're not repenting, and if we're not chastened, and if we're not modest, and we're not humble in all of our expectations, that allure creeps in, doesn't it? And so power is always ambiguous. And so what does that mean? It means we inhabit power faithfully when we're modest in our expectations and repent the fact that we all worship power. We inhabit power faithfully when we're modest in our expectations and repent of the fact that we all worship power. Okay, so power is derived, power is relational, power is generative, power is ambiguous, and I have 6 minutes. Really quickly, I hate to run over this quickly, but I'm going to have to. When you look at the life of Christ, yeah, okay. If you look at the life of Christ and we ask, what does the cross have to say about power? Which is a fairly important question. What does the cross have to say about power? And I think if you look at the mission of Christ, I actually think you see each of the aspects of what we just talked about today. What we see, we talked about how power is derived. And for Christ, power is not derived, but it was utterly submitted. So we read these remarkable statements about how Jesus says, I can't do anything on my own. I can only do what I see the Father doing. That there is a fundamental and a consistent and a radical submission of the power of Jesus to the power of the Father that I think parallels or at least gives us a glimpse that the right use of power is accountable and not for our own purposes. It fits with this idea of power being derived. Or when we look at the way that Jesus uses his power, the entire mission of Jesus is what we're talking about this entire weekend. It's the reconciling mission of Christ. To bring that which those relationships that have been marked by hostility and division and brokenness, and the entire mission of Christ, the reason that he left heaven behind, is so that he could reconcile and use power in the service of love, because power is always relational. And so when Jesus came to use power, the reason it looked so strange to the world was because Jesus was using it, understanding that it's fundamentally relational, in the service of others, to reweave human community with God and human community to itself and our relationship to all of creation. He was using it relationally. Or when we look, thirdly, at the nature of power is generative, what happens after Jesus ascends? It's the Holy Spirit. It's the birth of the church. He says, I breathe the Spirit upon you. You need me to go away, because if I don't, it's better for you to go. If I don't go away, the Spirit won't come. And what we see is the empowering of the people of God with the Spirit of God, because power is generative. When it's shared, when it's given, it multiplies. And lastly, the ambiguous nature of power. Jesus' use of power wasn't ambiguous, but what Jesus' perfect use of power did was it unmasked all human pretensions in our use of power. Colossians tells us that it disarmed the powers and principalities, nailing it to the cross. Jesus, in his faithful inhabiting of power as it was meant to be used, disarms and unmasks all worldly power for the fraud that it is, and reveals its pretensions at being God himself. So what we see in Jesus is that he uses power as is meant to be used, and the world has gotten so upside down that the only word we could use to describe this use of power is weakness. Our vocabulary became so utterly backwards that the first human expression of the right use of power, we name it weakness. And so the kingdom goes forward in weakness, the right use of power. So let me just pull out implications, power dynamics in a reconciled church. And I'm not going to get too far here, because I think many of you are further along in what this might mean than I am. So I don't want to presume to apply this. But I think it does force us to ask the question, are we watching power in our church? Is it something that we're aware of, attentive to? Are we watching power in the way that different racial groups or ethnic groups interact with one another? Are we watching power with regards to my race and ethnicity, and how I'm going to be interacting with somebody else of a different race or ethnicity? Am I attentive to that? And there's something interesting, I think, about being an Asian American male, because in some contexts, I flip to the disempowered side, and my approach looks very different. In other contexts, I flip to the more empowered side, and my approach has to look very different. And so if I'm not attentive to power, because it's inescapable, it's everywhere, then I can flatten out those power dynamics as though it didn't matter. Right? So am I attentive? Are we watching power dynamics in our churches, between groups, between individuals? Are we watching how we use power institutionally? So pastors, elders, people who make decisions, bodies that make institutional decisions. Are we aware of the relational nature of every decision that we make? Are we using that power in service of those who need power? Are we sharing that power in such a way that it generates power? Because we believe that power is not a zero-sum game. That for me to give power away doesn't mean that there's somehow less power for me, but that power is generated in that community in new and amazing ways. So as sessions, as pastors, as leaders, as those who hold institutional power, are we sharing that? Are we inviting people of different backgrounds and different voices and different perspectives in to share power at the institutional level? Are we intentional about that? Are we stewarding our power? Is that our approach to our power? Those sorts of things. Are we repenting of power? As leaders in particular. So those are some of the things that I want us to would love for you to ask, just as you consider, what do these dynamics look like in that reconciled church? If there's something to be said for all that we've talked about, what implications does it have for my church context, in my world, and that sort of thing? So those are the questions that maybe you can hammer out in your smaller groups, I guess. So should I close in prayer? Okay.
The schedule we gave you, it's really only a suggestion. So I think this is a really crucial issue. And we have different levels of experience and growth and wrestle around these things, and certainly different ethnic perspectives and majority perspectives that are crucial. Rather than have small group around this, if you don't mind, I think it might be better for us to stay together, get a few folks up here to sort of help be a panel and moderate discussion a bit and talk about this together collectively. Does that sound okay to everybody? So what we'll do is let's take 5 to 10 minutes most here, take a restroom break. If you want to get a glass of water or something, we'll be back in here.